Hey, hey, this is John Goldman. You're listening to Johnny's Secret Stash, and you're listening to us on Radio Harbor Country. That's WRHC 106.7 FM out of Three Oaks, Michigan, and WRHZ 93.5 out of Sawyer, Michigan. And we're here in the beautiful Sawyer, Michigan studio, and I'm here today with Scott Dresden. Scott is the newest member of the Edgar Wilbury Experience, playing guitar, and looking forward to talking with him today. Scott, let's bring you right in. How you doing?
Hey, great, John. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, good. Good to have you. And so you're a guitar player.
I've been playing guitar for quite a while, since I was probably 14 or 15.
Yeah.
I'll let you do the math on my age on that one, but...
I can't. It's too high a number.
Right. We're getting there.
Yeah. So, but right now you started playing with the Edgar Wilbury Experience and done a bunch of shows with them already, right?
Yeah, I'm fine. I think I'm finding my comfort zone with them. The Scipions have been playing with us, Nate and Leslie, and they're fantastic. You know, the whole band is, I mean, they're always real good. So yeah. Just trying to find my space in there, starting to happen.
Right, right. And so let's talk about your background. So it sounds like you started playing when you were 14. Did you play any other instruments before that?
Yeah, so I've always been interested in music. One of my earliest memories was Dizzy Gillespie playing trumpet. And I had to be... What's one of my earliest memories? 4 or 5 years old.
You know, his cheeks like puffing
cheeks
out.
All neck all puffed out. Yeah. Just I mean, putting everything he's got into it. And I was like, I want to play that. And I was, you know, in second, third grade, 6 or 7 probably when I started playing trumpet.
Oh wow, cool. So, did you take lessons at that time?
Yeah, I was in the school band, played through, you know, high school. I was always around musical people too. It seemed I was big into sports and music, so I was one of those kids that was, you know, on the soccer team, but I also, you know, did, you know, marching band and school band and stuff.
So. Well, and the school band is where you get the real education on notes and playing and, you know, that kind of thing. And
well, when I was young, I, you know, didn't appreciate it fully.
Of course.
You know, you got to sit there and learn a new language when you're 7, 8, 9 years old.
Yeah.
You're like, I go to school
it's
enough.
Torture.
Yeah, but, you know, now a lot of self-taught musicians don't know how to read music or,
for sure,
you know, have that language, which I'm very appreciative for at this point.
Yeah, yeah. So, with the trumpet, when's the last time you played trumpet? Like, you still able to play a trumpet?
Yeah, I can probably play, I would not say well, but well, it would take me a little bit to pick up and, you know, get the lip callus back. It's been 30 years. There's more math for
you. So you're 35?
Yeah, the 25th anniversary, my 35th birthday, or something ridiculous like that.
So what compelled you to pick up the guitar when you did?
I think, you know, I was going through that teenage time where, you know, kind of going through high school and listening to different types of music. A lot of rock and roll, you know, started entering my repertoire in you know, band days. And the people that played the French horn in band are now playing drums and, you know, we're playing Rush tunes and, you know, hanging out in somebody's garage trying to, you know, figure that out and be in a band and stuff. So, yeah, that all started when I was really young. I was very fortunate to be around people with like interests. You know, one of my greatest friends, Johnny Sturm, I was in a band with him when we were 15 called Stormy Days. And he's a really great drummer. I mean, he's played with a lot of people.
Oh, wow, cool. Did you ever play in like a, you know, band with friends as a trumpeter, or did you only get going on that when you started playing guitar?
Yeah, it really only got going. That kind of performance thing only got going when I started playing guitar. And I, even when I was, you know, 15, I got to see Neil Young play. And, you know, when I was real young, I 86 was my first Dead show. So, yeah, I was real young and got influenced by that, you know, kind of guitar-centric, you know, rock and roll sound, and seeing it live by people actually doing it. You know, I always thought it was very strange. You know, I was like, I can do that, you know, and I would love to do that.
Yeah. So when did you first pick up your guitar? I mean, how did that all come about? Did you already have a guitar and then started playing it, or did you borrow one from a friend, or, you know, what, how did that all come about?
Yes, one of the kids across the street had a guitar, and he was like plucking away at it and took a few lessons. I remember it was like this Les Paul, this really kind of Sears, you know, Roebuck, sure, Les Paul copy, gold top, super nice looking guitar. Uh-huh. But he took a bunch of lessons, and his dad was like, you know, hey, somehow figured it out with my dad, where he bought the guitar and the amplifier and gave it to me for my birthday because they knew I was kind of interested. Boy, howdy, that thing didn't stay in tune to save my life, but I tortured everybody around me listening to it.
Cool. Did you take lessons with the guitar?
So I took a couple lessons, a couple private lessons from about, I think, three different teachers. I didn't really, you know, mesh with people. Some guys want to show you this, and some guys think this is important. And, you know, I think with the background that I had, with the ability to read music and kind of speak the language, you know, I was at a certain level already with, I just needed to learn the notes on the guitar, essentially.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying? Like,
see,
okay, where's the
up.
E? Okay, I know, now I know, you know.
Right. And so what kind of music were you listening to at this time?
So, yeah, up? Like I said, I was exposed to a lot of really good music, what I would consider good music, but like rock and roll music became more forward in the repertoire, and more I started to listen to more improvisational music, you know, from jazz to you know, stuff like Jimi Hendrix, and like I said, I saw the Grateful Dead when I was very young, and Jerry Garcia was a, you know, incredibly large influence on my interest in paying more attention to music and making, you know, intellectual, like improvisational type music that, you know, it's not quite jazz and it's not quite bluegrass and it's not quite, you know, something
right.
else.
Like taking that bass song and then working around it and kind of, you know, highlighting this and, you know, stepping out of the lines and kind of coming back into it. That was always my thrill with listening to Jerry Garcia play guitar, that he could do that so seamlessly. Just, you know, followed a simple tune even. You know, a lot of the songs that he sang, especially some of the solo stuff, were these, you know, R&B covers or whatever, and he just, you know, created out of that and extended them out, and I just love that stuff. You know, some of that stuff with Merle Saunders and, who's the other guy that he played with?
Clarence Clemens played with him a lot,
yeah,
on saxophone
right.
when he toured. Yeah, the people that Rob Wasserman and the people that were John Kahn
was his bass guy. Yeah,
he's had some really phenomenal, and some of his shows were, I mean, absolutely amazing.
Did you ever see Jerry Garcia on a solo
tour? Yeah,
quite
a few. And if
really?
You remember Poplar Creek, I think
sure,
it was '89,
yeah.
And
up
was in
Hoffman Estates.
Yeah, that place was actually, it was fun to go to.
It became like a Sears complex,
yeah,
or
something
like
some
that.
Corporate, yeah, yeah, some man. Corporate complex.
But that was quite the destination for a long time for all of us too. Yeah.
Yep.
You know, you mentioned that you had a band with this guy, this friend of yours, and what kind of music did you guys play in the band? And Stormy Waters, was it called?
Stormy Days.
Stormy
and of course,
Days.
You know, I mean, again, we were young. It was Days with Daze, of
uh-huh.
course.
Oh, good.
I mean, we played, you know, Police tunes. We played Pink Floyd, all kind of stuff. I mean, Johnny and I played a lot of Rush. When we were very young, we tried to, you know, get that sort of intricate, improvisational yet, you know, rehearsed kind of tight sound, so that was always, you know.
So you're always reaching for that that ability to add your own creative touch to it as you were playing it.
Yeah
And even at an early stage when you were, you know, just trying to master the guitar itself.
Yeah, absolutely
great.
No, it's always been, you know, I've always been a big Frank Zappa fan. I named
one
of my sons after Frank, and it's always that kind of like, does humor belong in music? You know, you can say that with this. You could be serious about your music, but sometimes there needs to be that, you know, not to Frank's extent sometimes, but, you know, some levity and, you know, some let's have fun doing this.
Right.
And, you know,
and that's the funny
serious.
Thing, because his songs were sort of goofy. Frank Zappa songs were kind of sort of goofy and, you know, inside jokes and intelligence. But he himself was always so serious. Like he, except, you know, he kind of looked goofy, but like, you know, and ever hear an interview of him, he's like very serious all the time. And he ran his band like a, you know, like a dictator.
In a way, yes. Yeah, he was very demanding. But he also composed for and conducted the London Symphony Orchestra on his own dime with his own, you know, like
music. That was probably one of his dreams, you know.
It absolutely was, and he was able to do it. And, I mean, again, the recordings are out there. A lot of people probably haven't heard it or, you know, they think Frank Zappa and they think Watch Out Where the Huskies Go.
Yeah.
I mean, I know I do because it's a great song.
Right.
But, yeah, no, he did things both absolutely seriously, but he took his music seriously, but he wanted it to be entertaining and, you know, kind of, you know, funny and make you think.
Yeah, yeah. So where did you see your first Grateful Dead show?
Was that Alpine Valley in 86.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I think I might have been there. That's funny. That was when they allowed camping in the parking lot.
Like, and in down on the golf course, too. You did, they didn't have it blocked off. And I probably can't tell the stories of things that I saw down on the golf course in 86 on the radio.
So. I know. Isn't it funny that, and now they're so strict up there and all these places, you know?
Well, partially because, I mean, you know, you got thousands of people down there, like, sitting around the hotel, and you got people on vacation with their family, like,
Yeah, right.
People are walking
mind
around.
Mind if we play through?
Exactly. Yeah, mind if we play through your poncho tent city you got going on there?
Yeah. That was, those were interesting times for sure. And, you know, it got so much worse, like in the early 90s, when there would be as many people in the parking lot not able to get into the show as there were actually in the show. And, you know, it just became like people were getting hurt. And, you know, being irresponsible. And it was like they were going there not for the music, but in order to have an excuse to be irresponsible. It was a very strange, strange time. And they were, you know, Grateful Dead in particular was getting banned from music venues. They weren't allowed to play places. And, you know, it's sort of funny because now with Dead and Company, all these guys have grown up. And they're bringing their kids.
It's
kind of a funny turn.
Did you see I saw some pictures of a shakedown, quote unquote, shakedown street at the Sphere.
Oh, no. Well, it's real organized.
Las Vegas isn't letting you get away with anything. So, yeah, you got to have a license and everything's like, you know, squared off. And, you know, nobody's sitting on a blanket cooking a grilled cheese right there, which is
they have them pre-made and wrapped
packaged,
probably.
Maybe USDA stamp is on there.
The Department of Health, you know, has inspected their equipment. It kind of takes away from the taste.
It is pretty clean. The scene has become pretty clean.
Well, you know, it's just the way that things work these days. You
absolutely
know?
That's good to have it though. I mean, it's just good that it still exists in any form that's close to
And you know what, it's all about creating an environment for the musicians to express their creativity. And so, you know, all for that. And it's not about, you know, all the other stuff. And so this is what the focus is now. And it's working out pretty good, I think.
Yeah, and I think the band is actually, they're a lot better. You know, I was kind of surprised when they decided last year to do the, you know, final tour. Because I really feel that since what did they start in 2015 or 16 or something touring
right after Fairly Well and
it took them a while to get the wheels turning. You know, I mean it's mm-hmm. the band with a reputation, and you know, John I think has finally fully embraced, you know, his impact on music at this point, which, you know, I mean that a lot of people come to see them still, packed stadiums,
right? And you mentioned that you know, you're really happy with the progression that John Mayer has made in playing with Dead and Company and you know, finding his spot. You know, he's not Jerry Garcia. He's not trying to be Jerry Garcia. And, you know, it's a different band. It's like, I mean, I might not even be the first person to say this, but they're basically a Grateful Dead cover band, but composed of original Grateful Dead members. So
that's, you know, exact. Well, I mean, that is exactly right. And that could hold true for any band, you know, say Journey or whoever, yeah, without, you know, certain members. You're keeping the name and you have all the songs. But yeah, I think John's come a long way. I have to admit, I wasn't the biggest John Mayer fan in the beginning. For more technical, I think, musical reasons. And like I said, he's embraced more of the, I think, the sound of the music as, you know, interpreted by the rest of the members as well, you know. And it's kind of Bobby's show. He's right. He's the old man on the block,
yeah,
now. And
which is so ironic because he was the young kid the whole time.
The young kid, yeah.
For the longest time. Yeah, he's definitely embraced his... His wisdom, wise self, and he's got that big old beard.
Yep.
And
and I really think they started to mesh a lot better on the last. Yeah. Maybe it was, you know, vibes of the last tour and that kind of contributed to it a bit. But I think musically, if you go back and honestly listen to it, it's probably the best stuff that they've done.
Yeah.
You know, and I get to go out on a high note, but you know what? If you can keep that going, but you know, what is it, a 40 show residency at the Sphere?
Something like that. Yeah. They're going to be playing a lot of shows there, which, you know, begs the question. I mean, how many, you know, the whole point is, that each show, especially in the old days, was just kind of like, they just felt it. They just, you know, they would just tickle out a song or in the middle of toward the end of a song, they would, you know, kind of hint at what the next song was going to be, and then they all start, you know, getting into that. But now they've got their song list preset, you know, the set list pre-printed, and it's all at their feet. They know which song's going to play next. Sometimes they deviate a little bit, but, you know, sometimes you see after the show they scratched out a song and, like, put in something else. But for the most part, you know, they are following a little bit of a script, although they always make the song an original song, you know, by playing it the way they want to. It's not like they're, you know, following strict music notes or things like that.
But yeah, correct. The music is still, I would call it improvisational,
yeah,
you know, jam band,
right,
type music.
Yeah.
But yeah, yeah.
You know, I think that that's necessary for them to have a song list or a set list because, you know, there's so many other factors going on these days. The lights and the videos, you know, in the back of the audience.
Yeah, it all has to be synced up.
It has
stuff
to be synced up,
especially
to a certain
at the Sphere.
Extent, at least to be able to know, especially at the Sphere. Yeah, yeah. But, you know, even just in the past couple of years, I mean, they've really needed to do that. And just so the sound guys know, like, oh, yeah, okay, we're on this song. We got to do this. If they just picked a song out of the hat from the repertoire, from the,
right,
you know, the
right,
archives, then, you know, the sound guy, the light guys would be going nuts trying to match it up or figure out where they want to go with it. And this way there's a little bit, and it makes it a tighter light show. You know, or I guess video show or whatever you'd call it, you know.
Yeah.
Visual. Yeah, yeah. Tighter visuals as a result.
Well, I think too, like, for, and I would love to know the answer to this. I know that the Dead used set lists for a bit, excuse me, towards,
yeah,
the end. Even with they had, you know, teleprompters, uh-huh, and things like that. And, I mean, I could see that they played probably 100 different songs, you know,
right,
unique songs on a year's different tours. But yeah, they were using set, you know, that like 60s 70s kind of thing where they would just go out there and be like, yeah, we're just gonna play whatever we want,
yeah, as loud and fast as they could,
you know.
That was like sort of their mantra for a while.
Correct. But yeah, no, I think that, and again, I would love to know that, and maybe I'll look that up. I see when they started using kind of pre-probe, because you could tell almost when they were, you know, improvising song slots. You know what I mean? Like, you can, there are certain tapes you'll listen back to. I think one was in 87 or 88 where Brent was playing. He was coming out of space going in. He wanted to play Gloria. And you can hear it. Sometime I'll have to play that for you. Where Jerry slams the door and, like, he just turns the volume up, goes into the wheel chord.
Oh, hilarious.
And the whole thing is, yeah.
Yeah, I love those kind of, like, backstage antics, or, you know, that backstage communication.
Yep.
They're, you know, the Grateful Dead are famous for their ability to kind of read each other during the show. And there's that, you know... April 7th, 1977, 5777, I think. You know, at Cornell.
Yeah, Barton Hall.
And they talk about that being like they were all just in this zone, this like telepathic zone where they were reading each other's minds and being able to just create intertwining with each other. And, you know, that's always been looked at as like this special result of this this telepathy that they all were aiming for.
And, you know, one of the funny things about that, and I remember when I was younger, I had a really good connection for tapes. And that, of course, you know, Cornell was one of the big 5777. But we were both blessed with a band that, multiple blessed, with a band that was not only, you know, at really good form musically together. I believe Betty Cantor Jackson was the one who did the recordings of a lot of those shows. So when they first entered circulation, they were called Betty Boards.
Oh.
And I remember like 5'7", 5'9". I think there's maybe a 5'5 or a 5'10 because it was like Cornell, Buffalo. All those shows were not only flawless recordings that were, you know, given
to the
general.
If you had a soundboard recording.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
If you had the right connections, but also those performances. Because if you look, there is a lot of argument, and rightfully so, that, you know, certain shows from that particular portions of the tour. I mean, you can argue whatever you want about the Scarlet Fire from, you know, Cornell, but the Buffalo War Memorial Help on the Way, Slipknot, Franklin's Tower was maybe one of the best ones they did ever.
Really?
Too. So,
okay.
Yeah, there's all those different. Yeah, and as you dig more, that's one thing I love about the Dead and listening to like older live recordings is that, you know, some of the things that people, you know, it's this show or that show. Mm-hmm. God, and then you start digging in.
There's magic in so many of the shows. It might not be the whole show, but there were some very magical moments with many of those shows, for sure.
Yeah, and they could turn it on a dime,
you know,
like, for sure, with some of their ideas.
Well, they were way ahead of their time to even, you know, first of all, to just always be looking to have the best equipment. And that was, Owsley was a big part of that.
Yeah, and, with Alembic, you know, musical instruments, mm-hmm. you know, who all those guys that, you know, did all that research. And I mean, all those speakers, all the instruments were hand wired.
Yeah.
They went to the nth degree.
They really did. They brought the level of musical equipment up a big notch. And, you know, here were these guys, they, you know, barely were selling albums, and they were basically touring to support themselves. Now, you know, the market is that you put out an album in order to get people to come to shows, and then,
right.
You know, the ticket rates these days are far in excess of you know, it's not a simple, cycle of the economy. I mean, these tickets
right.
are far more expensive than they ever were,
right.
You know, based on what the dollar was worth or whatever, because that's their livelihood these days.
Yeah, and I mean, even back in the day, the Grateful Dead always went round and round with record labels, and, you know, they tried to make their own.
Yeah.
Ticket sales, they tried to do mail order, you know, they tried to get...
They did that pretty successfully. They kind of created that
yeah,
that ability
to keep other people from, you know, mm-hmm. dipping their hand. Everybody's got, that's why things are so expensive ticket wise now, because, you know, the venue has to have their money. And I mean, yeah, the artist could fight it, but
yeah, right.
Not how really. Ticketmaster owns all the venues, all yeah. the big venues anyway.
Right.
And then those guys sort of saw this coming, you know, all those, you know, hippie, Neil Young, Grateful Dead, Allman Brothers kind of bands yeah. were always trying to figure out a way to, you know, control their own ticket sales.
Right.
In a way, you know, yeah, other people are going to make money and that's fine, but...
Yeah, Neil Young's still pushing back. Like, he pulled his stuff from Spotify for a while.
Absolutely. He's on tour. He's doing yeah. I haven't listened to any yet.
I think he came to Chicago last Thursday or something.
I regret missing.
I know. I was thinking the same thing. I was like, how much, you know, what would that look like to drive into Chicago to go check him out?
Would have been fantastic. Yeah,
I'm a huge Neil Young fan, and he may be the only musician that I love that much that I have not gotten to see. Taj Mahal also I have not gotten to
yeah,
see
I have
Taj
not,
Mahal.
Not I have not seen Taj Mahal. But Neil Young, a couple times. Neil now if you get an opportunity, definitely go.
He has not been looking good for about 20 years, that dude.
I haven't listened to any of the tour, and it keeps popping up on my YouTube feed to watch it, but I saw him walking out on stage with the other members of Crazy Horse, and I was like, maybe I don't want to listen to it. You know, I want to have my memories of younger Neil.
Yeah.
No, I'm sure it's fantastic.
You know, Neil was touring for a while with The Promise of the Real, Luke, what's his name? Luke Nelson.
I was going to say Willie Nelson. That's funny. Yeah. It's funny you came up. Couldn't think of it, and I was sitting here with it right on the tip of my tongue.
Help me out here. Throw me a bone. But, you know, who's another great startup in that area?
Absolutely.
Luke Nelson.
Willie, speaking of Luke, I mean, Willie has always been, I mean, even from the back days, like, you know, Working Man's Dead was, you know, in the early 70s, and that whole, you know, kind of Western story vibe that Willie Nelson, Johnny Cash, and all those older country guys had. And Willie, there's another one. Have not seen him, even at his age, I forget the name of his guitar. He's got his guitar named.
Not Lucy. Not Lucille. That was B.B. King. It's Trigger.
Trigger. Yeah.
And he's still playing with a big hole in it.
Still playing it. And, you know, I saw him in California a couple years ago. And he came out and, you know, he started playing. It was almost like he wasn't warmed up. And I was like, this might be interesting, because he's getting up there in age. He was sitting down and everything. I'll tell you what, by the second song, Whiskey River came out. 25,000 people were.
Unbelievable. You know. Yeah. Well, he still does that picnic each year. And now he's doing the Outlaw Festival. I mean, he's all over the place. I mean, he's quite the, you know, testament to good, healthy living. I think that's the bottom line. You know,
he's been a big legalization proponent for the last 50 years or so. Good, healthy living.
Really? I mean, you know, it's we can talk about that all day, but he takes care of himself, and he makes music and stress relief a priority. I think he's answering some questions there.
Well, and I think performance is a stress relief. You know, mm-hmm. it's like to be able to do those things. You know, and he has to be taking care of himself. All these guys that are in their 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, maybe touring. Yeah. Like, that's not the easiest life.
Hard work, yeah.
And but you get, I'm sure you get used to it, and you know the payoff is. You know,
you get
yourself
in a. I'm sure you get yourself in a routine. Like, look at Bob Weir. I don't know if you follow him on Instagram, but like, you know, he any town he goes to, he sets up, you know, some kind of workout thing, and he like gets other people to work out with him. And these guys, you know, they've got their schedules. And even, you know, the Rolling Stones, Mick Jagger. I mean, I remember when I was in high school hearing about how he would bring like his workout, you know, equipment with him. Like there'd be a truck of, you know, his, you know, running machine or whatever. And, you know, they, it's not just all partying and having people in their rooms till, you know, 4 a.m. and everything. It's, you know, this is my job and I gotta, you know, take care of myself. And these guys do, you know.
Yeah,
and
so Keith Richards somehow built a reputation on being the biggest partier of everything you could partake of. And he is somehow magically not only still alive, but touring like nobody's business. It's got to be
with a cigarette hanging out of his mouth anywhere he goes. I mean,
I don't think he's got a reputation. Let's just say that. Yeah, you think he's... Which is cool. I mean, you know what I mean? If you can, like... become famous and have that rock and roll, you know, maybe when he was in his 20s, he was, you know, a madman. I mean, just, you know, look at Ozzy.
I think he probably took it into his late 30s or 40s.
Right. I mean, there's at this age, I mean, the guy's pushing 80 years old, right?
Yeah.
If he's not already.
He might already be older than 80. Yeah. These guys are getting pretty old. Yeah. But, Bob Weir was the baby and now he's, I think, 78, 79?
No, he's getting up there, too.
But Bill Kreutzmann and Mickey Hart are, you know, in their 80s, I'm sure.
Yeah, and the drumming. I mean, I couldn't imagine being a drummer and being on tour for years and years. You would have to take it easy, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, Neil Peart, he'd always say, what's the hardest thing to do while singing, you know, because sometimes being a singer, you got to take care of your voice, you got to do that. Mm-hmm. But he's like, second hardest thing? Yeah, drumming. The for drummers, sure. Because you're always moving, and the more active you are. Yeah. I mean, imagine doing that for 40 years and, you know,
for living on 3 hours a night, you know,
every night.
Yeah. Right. It's got to be quite the workout to be a drummer for sure. I mean, listen, just standing up there sometimes, you know, I can imagine that.
Oh, absolutely.
I remember seeing, I think they were called at that time like Further, or it was in the mid 2000s.
Yep.
And it was Bob Weir and Phil Lesh and maybe the drummers too, Bill and Mickey, but they were playing at Northerly Island in Chicago.
Yep.
And it was like 100 degrees outside at night. And I'm standing there, I'm like just, you know, so uncomfortable. That was my thing. Like I would be like, I had trouble going to concerts because I'd be so physically uncomfortable standing there. My back would be hurting. My feet would be hurting. And then I'm looking up there and I'm thinking like, geez, Phil Lesh is up there. He's 70? This is when he was 70.
Right.
And he had liver transplant.
Right.
He doesn't even have his original liver. And I'm like, I got to step it up. This is bad news. I shouldn't be, you know, complaining about it. And he's up there playing for 3 hours. So that was when I was like, you know,
Holding that big old bass up.
Yeah. I mean,
Phil always played the big bass with all the electronics and, you know, people, it's after a while, it starts to feel pretty heavy.
Oh, I bet. Those basses are pretty big. You know, I remember Phil's bass, he'd have, you know, one string, like, track to one set of speaker, and he would, like, you know, separate them all out. And so you would just, like, it would just be this big circle of sound every time.
Yeah, and that was part of the Wall of Sound, and, you know, the whole Alembic, his bass was designed by, I can't remember the name of the luthier, but he was a former Alembic employee, I think.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, they had it controlled. Matter of fact, one of these days I'm going to have to introduce you to a friend of mine. His name's Mike Wald. He actually does the electronics for some of their guitars. He sent me pictures of Phil's bass all taken apart.
Oh, man. Wow.
It kind of did. I shouldn't be talking about it, actually. but no, like the electronics that were in there, and especially during that Wall of Sound period in the early 70s, he could literally just flip a switch and, you know, go from this set of speakers over here behind him to that set of speakers over there and vice versa, and then change the phase of everything. Yeah, the Dead movie, actually. They
talked about that a little bit.
That was in the Dead movie. Yeah.
It's been a while. That might have been where I heard that from. And I'm always forgetting what they call that speaker thing that has sort of like a round a cylinder that's in there, and it circles around, and it kind of sends the sound to different spots. You know, it's constantly
it's like a Leslie speaker.
Yeah, that's a Leslie speaker. Those things must weigh like 200 pounds.
It's like one of those organic kind of phaser, you know, swirly sounds that that are very popular. One of my favorite guitar players, Warren Haynes. That's a component in his rig. Trey Anastasio uses from one Fish. And has one for years. Yeah. Brent Midland, that was his Leslie.
I thought it was Phil's. It was connected to Phil's.
You might be right.
I don't know.
I always thought it was Brent's.
Because it was sort of near Phil. It was like to his.
Yeah.
Right.
And there could have been two.
Could have been. Yeah.
Certain points. I can say I remember a lot, but not everything.
So we're about halfway, and I just wanted to remind the audience, I'm talking to Scott Dresden, the newest guitar player for Edgar Wilbury Band, and you're listening to Johnny Secret Stash. I'm John Goldman, and you're listening to us on Radio Harbor Country. That's WRHC 106.7 out of Three Oaks and WRHZ 93.5 out of Sawyer, Michigan. So, Scott... you brought a guitar. Do you want to play any songs?
I did. I have a song. I think I mentioned Jerry Garcia at some point, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was a big influence. I'd like to play one of his songs.
All right. Well, let's break
Maybe
it out.
We can talk about it afterwards.
Okay. Sounds good. So while Scott's getting all set up there, what looks like a Taylor guitar. Very nice. All right. Yeah, maybe get your headphones back on. Make it easier. Trying to do three things at once here. All right. Oh, we gotta turn.
As in life, I'm horribly unprepared.
Oh, it's fully tuned.
How's that sound? All right.
Sounds great. Yeah.
Time. Reach for the sun, catch hold of the moon. They're both too heavy, what can you do? Reach for the stars, smack into the sky, yeah. You don't want to live, but you're chicken to die. Ooh, you're chicken to die. Run, run, run for the roses. Quicker it opens, sooner it closes. Man, oh friend of mine. All good things and all good time. Reach for the money, caught short on the rent. Big ideas, cash, it's all spent. The trouble with love is it's on the face, yeah. You just want the cup, but you don't want the rain. Ooh, you don't want the rain. Run, run, run for the roses. Quicker it opens, sooner it closes. Man, oh friend of mine. All good things and all good time. Reach for the rose, catch hold of the briar. Run for the roses, you want me to love. Next thing there's a fire. Run for the roses, you got the dory, I got the me, yeah. Run for the roses, I got a notion, yeah, we're all at sea. Ooh, we're all at sea. Run, run, run for the roses. Quicker it opens, sooner it closes. Man, oh friend of mine. all good things and all good time. Run, run, run for the roses, quicker it opens, the sooner it closes. Man, oh friend of mine, all good things and all good time, all good things and all good time.
All right. I love that one. That's a old favorite of mine, too.
Wow, Run for the Roses. Yeah, it's it was 1982, I think. That was his last studio release, I believe.
What, and was that, which album was that on?
Run for the Roses.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yep, 82.
Did you write that one with Robert Hunter? He did a lot of writing with Robert Hunter.
Yeah, most of it. I mean, most of the lyrics are written by Hunter, which, you know, if you ever listen to Robert, there's a lot of good, Robert played a lot of good shows, but I mean, he was a wordsmith.
Oh yeah.
And it's that song is a great metaphor, like, you know, the Kentucky Derby, and it's a great metaphor for, you know, the gate opening, the sooner it opens, the sooner it closes. Yeah, there's just a lot of that's what I love about jam band music in general, but the Dead in particular, is a lot of their lyrics are metaphor based, and you know, different people interpret it a different way. Like,
absolutely,
you know, it's one of those things where it just magic like that, where and it's legitimately can mean those things that people are interpreting them. You know, there's really no wrong answer.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point. I remember hearing that about, you know, Robert Hunter, or maybe even hearing Robert Hunter talk about that, is that, you know, his lyrics, you know, kind of were open for interpretation. And when I hear a particular song, you know, we're hearing the music too. And maybe we don't even understand what words are being sung. Some of the words, like, don't even seem to fit together. But you sort of get this impression of what this song is about. And, you know, there's little things that that come out in the songs, and you kind of get this view of it. You know, that song, The Loser, or... anyway, there are many songs like that where I listen to it, and you kind of, like, even think you're knowing what the lyrics are, and they might not even be the right lyrics.
That's correct. That's absolutely correct. And Robert Hunter is kind of famous for not really sharing any interpretations of those songs for that purpose exactly, because the whole point, and I think his whole creative point, you know, with the whole psychedelic scene, was just to put it out there and let people interpret it how they wish. You know, and that really speaks to, I think, the jam band, you know, scene in general, you know, the Allman Brothers, Bob Dylan, any of those people that were, you know, fantastic wordsmiths. If you listen to the music, you know, you could be thinking about it one way, and then you talk to somebody about it, and like, hey, what do you think about this? And they're like, you know, I mean, what's the eyes of the world? What does it mean to wake up and be the eyes of the world to you? You know what I mean?
It's
pretty deep, but it can also be pretty surface. You know, like, how it goes as deep as you want, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned Bob Dylan, and that he was the ultimate wordsmith, almost to the point where, you know, some of the stuff he was writing, maybe it had no meaning at all. You know, like, I remember an early interview of him in that Scorsese movie, which I don't recall the name of. And he was being interviewed, and he was kind of like, hey, you know, I'm just here. The stuff comes through me.
Right.
And I don't assign any meaning to any of this. You know, I'm just creating within this genre. And, you know, but we listened to it and we're like, oh my God, Bob Dylan, where is this coming from? And this guy's, you know, godlike. And you know, that is almost like a godlike thing to create, to channel this music and these lyrics that, you know, just, speak volumes.
Right. You can call it a lot of different things. And I think a lot of those people, you know, when people understand their music, when you get it, like a lot of people get Bob Dylan, you know, it's very creative. And for the time period, when, you know, when he came out at, what was that, Monterey, or, you know, in 65, whatever that was, you know, I mean, the words that he was using were kind of foreign to, you know, Western music completely in general. And then
where they booed him off stage because
he played an electric guitar.
At the Newport Folk Festival.
Something like, and he pulled out an electric, and they were booing. that was him, you know, pushing the boundaries of folk music. And you know, I think I mentioned that. My first Dead show was back in 86 when I was young. That we got there the day before, like a lot of, you got the guys that are on the road, and back then you could show up the day before and camp in the parking lot. Well, we got there, traffic jam getting into Alpine. I'm like, geez, the day before everybody's showing up.
Amazing.
Well, no, Tom Petty and Bob Dylan were playing that night. So not only did I get to see the Dead the next night, but I got to see Petty and Dylan together back at that time. And I think that was right after Bob's motors. He had a motorcycle accident.
Oh, that was, I think, in the 70s.
Was that?
I believe it was like 76 or so. But then that's when he stopped being able to play guitar.
He
didn't stop composing.
But Bob was always, I mean, he did that tour with the Dead. Jerry were like best friends for a long time.
Imagine Bob Dylan being friends with
anyone.
He's this enigma, absolute enigma. And now he's got that funny looking mustache. I mean,
seen him, and he's on tour. I think the never ending. He's just going to stop, but he's playing these like tiny theaters. My buddy in California saw him, you know, in Santa Cruz, and it's 1,000 seat.
Yeah.
Place, which I mean, more power to him.
Yeah,
he actually, you know, and for a lot of people who don't understand the connection between Bob and the Dead, I think I was looking at some of his set lists for his last tour, and I think he was in Japan or Spain. This man has written some of the greatest songs written. He can play any music he wants to play, but who does he decide to cover? He pulled out some Grateful Dead songs.
That's funny. The Dead, I think some of their covers of his songs are some of the best renditions of Bob Dylan songs.
Yeah, I need to pull out some interviews, but I think Bob said
Queen Jane Approximately and...
Jerry did Tangled Up in Blue
Tangled Up in Blue. He did that as a solo thing.
Yep.
But
That last song, Run for the Roses, was kind of copied off of... Tangled Up in Blue. It's the same.
Yeah, kind of the same. Role
and Jerry even said,
kind
of like an homage to Bob's chord progression there.
Yeah, you know, it's really, and Bob Dylan didn't stretch it out like the Grateful Dead do, and so it just becomes all that more magical. We'll hear the Dead cover a Bob Dylan song.
Yeah, or even like Fish. I mean, those guys can take some cover songs to. Really and funny different places. And one of the things, and I don't mean to change the subject, but I think Fish is one of those jam bands that they're really at the top. In my opinion, they are the
they are just killing
I don't like
it.
To use the word best, but they are really in amazing form. Like go to see them. If they're on tour, you're not going to be disappointed.
Oh, they're always pulling out something new.
They're always doing cool stuff. I think it says a lot too. Maybe they weren't the first residency at the Sphere, but the newest, hotness is the Sphere. Yeah. U2 had played 4 shows or something like that, and that's cool. But, who plays next? I mean, they could have anybody there. They could have had anybody there.
Right.
And, let's have Fish come in. And, I mean, how often are they ever played on the radio? And then after Fish, it's who are we going to ask next?
What is the radio anymore?
Yeah. It's right here,
I guess. But, I don't think people get their music through the radio anymore.
Yeah, but you know what I'm saying. Like, let's talk about concert ticket sales. Yeah. And Taylor Swift is probably in the lead in that. There, Bruce Springsteen. Why wouldn't Bruce be invited?
It's their combination of music that keeps you going, along with the visual effects.
Yep.
And no better place to see visual effects than the Sphere. By the way, did I tell you I'm going to see Dead & Company at the Sphere?
That's kind of why I've been talking about it a little bit. I'm a little jealous because I'm not getting to go. But
it was a last minute thing, and I was okay, I'm doing it.
Those are the best. And,
yeah.
Usually.
Flying through like 3 cities to get there, but I'm doing it. staying at a shitty little hotel. Oh, excuse me. Staying in a little hotel just off the, you know, just to.
Yeah, oh,
just
yeah, yeah. I'm very off of, Lake Mead Boulevard there down on the west side of Lake Mead. Yeah, I've been there.
Yeah, so that's all part of the adventure for sure. And it's going to be just unbelievable.
Yeah.
Just some of those videos of fish being there with, you know, just these graphics on the, like, everywhere. In the, I mean, you know, the whole place gets, in one flick of a switch, they can make it, you know, like this fake cloud thing to, you know, the moon or whatever.
Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah, pretty much whatever they want to do. Whatever or they you can almost imagine. You know, and I think that's part of it, too, that a lot of people may not think about and has been for a long time, but that, you know, lighting show / graphic show. You know, back in the 60s, what did they do? Take two pieces of plastic and put some kind of liquid between them and put a light behind it. Right. And that was like this cool lava lamp thing. And then disco balls and, you know, stuff like that. But now, you know, I mean, back in the day, the dead
downright immersive
were
experience.
Pretty minimalist. You know what I mean? Yeah. They had a black curtain in back with maybe some, like a steel your face up there. And that was it. A bunch of music equipment laid out on stage. And, you know, then it turned into big screen TVs. And now, you know, they can do whatever. I mean, the lighting guy for Fish, I wish I remembered his name. The guy's an artist in and of himself.
Who, right.
You know, he's notorious for doing, like, lighting show solos.
Well, and that's, exactly. And that's the magic of it, too, is that they give homage to these guys that are, you know, you'd normally look at as being sort of the support people, but they have their own big roles. You know, Grateful Dead, too, is, you know, like Steve Parrish is a well-known person.
Yep.
And he was, you know, the stage manager.
Yep.
And, you know, but he's got his own things to say about that genre. I mean, he's got his own show and everything. And then, you know, everyone knows Robert Hunter and, you know, being the supporting lyric writer for Jerry Garcia and a couple of Bobby songs and... you know, so all these guys that aren't sitting at the front of the stage are still well known because of just this broad appreciation of everything going on stage. It's a pleasure to see.
Yeah, and it's a whole, like, huge team effort. You know, the sound guy, the lighting guy. I mean, without any of those people, you know, it's nowhere near, you know, what you're seeing up there. And to have a really good sound crew, you know, backing you up, and a really good lighting crew. And those guys are pushing, you know, the limits of what they can do, you know, technologically wise and, you know, knowledge wise of just having either a good ear or a good eye for lights and creativity. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of artists that aren't up there, you know, playing an instrument, performing, but, you know,
they're just as
generally
part of the show
no less
anyway.
Important to the overall experience of everything. Yeah, especially nowadays. I mean, people have come to expect, and, you know, maybe rightfully so, it's good to go and see something other than a bunch of music equipment laid out on stage with a black screen behind you.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, it kind of helps you appreciate the music even more. With a little bit of visual assistance.
Sure.
Hey, do you want to play another song? You still have your guitar on your lap.
yeah, I can play one. I got a long one. Do we have time?
We got time. We have 8 minutes.
8 minutes. I'll wrap it up quick.
Okay. Or you know what we can do? We can just do the closing stuff and then have you play it out to the end of the.
Yeah, that'd work.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm sitting here with Scott Dresden, and you're listening to Johnny's Secret Stash. I'm John Goldman, and you're listening to us on Radio Harbor Country. That's WRHC 106.7 FM out of Three Oaks, Michigan, and WRHZ 93.5 out of Sawyer, Michigan. And we got Scott Dresden. You know, we should do a show about these jam bands. I mean, all this talk about jam bands, maybe we should start doing a show like that.
You know, it's weird. I think, you know, you were asking me questions and we got on that discussion and it we just kind of couldn't stop. We should definitely explore this further because I think, I could talk to you. We could talk for hours about this stuff.
Yeah, right.
I mean, if anybody's interested in listening to it.
Well, we'll find out. So where are you going to play?
So I think I mentioned Eyes of the World earlier.
Eyes of the World.
What does it mean
to
you?
One of my favorites. All right. All right, here we go. Eyes of the World.
Try to do Jerry
Grateful Dead song.
Right outside the lazy summer home, you ain't got time to call your soul a critic known. Right outside the lazy gate, a winter's summer home. Wondering where the nuthatch winners, wings a mile long, just carry that bird away. Wake up to find out you are the eyes of the world. The heart has its beaches, its homeland, and thoughts of its own. Wake now, discover you are the song that the morning brings. Heart has its seasons, its evenings, and songs of its own. Comes a redeemer, and he slowly too fades away. Follows away behind him that's loaded with clay. Seeds that were silent on burst into bloom and decay. Night comes quiet, it's close on the heels of the day. Wake up, of the world. The heart has its beaches, its homeland, and thoughts of its own. Wake now, discover you are the song that the morning brings. The heart has its seasons, its evenings, and songs of its own. Our own. Sometimes we visit your country and live in your home. Sometimes we ride on your horses. Sometimes we walk alone. Sometimes songs that we hear, they're just songs of our own. Wake up to find out you are the eyes of the world. The heart has its beaches, its homeland, and thoughts of its own. Wake now, discover you are the song that the morning brings. Heart has its seasons, its evenings, and songs of its own.